Okay, I'm going to call the meeting for the Committee on Long-Term Care to order. Members, please take your seats. Let's see if we have a quorum. We don't have, we have one, two. Boone Higgin is here. Okay. Since we have a quorum, I'm going to ask the member to approve the minutes from Monday, January 14th. Is there a motion? Okay, thank you. Representative Cleavorn moves the minutes from January 14th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Minutes approved. Okay, members, today we have several presentations. We are joined by Commissioner Jan Malcolm, who is going to talk about the Vulnerable Adult Protection Dashboard and the Office of Health Facility Complaints Backlog. She's going to give the House an update. I believe this may be the first update. I know you gave one to the Senate, so this is our first chance that we're going to have an update here in the House. And then she's going to talk about the working groups and an overview of elder and vulnerable adult abuse that she has convened in the fall. And then we'll have other members talking about other working group results if we have time. If not, we'll move it to next week where we're going to hear additional reports from the working groups that have been convened over the fall as we try to work together on a bipartisan bill to address these issues, these very important issues. So, Commissioner Malcolm, welcome to the Long-Term Care Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jan Malcolm. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health and very much appreciate the opportunity to spend a little bit of extra time with you today, just trying to give you kind of the background and the context in which we will continue working together on policy improvements to better protect vulnerable adults and elders in our state. So we're going to kind of take a step backwards, and I will describe to you kind of what the Health Department's role in regulating health care providers and facilities and investigating complaints so that you have kind of an understanding of the process that has gotten so much important and needed attention over the last couple of years, and then segue into the policy recommendations that we hope to work with you on this session. So I will just move fairly quickly. I think you all have, I hope you have copies of the slides because I'm not going to go through every point on every slide, but hopefully you can refer back to it. So as I mentioned, and for those who were in the Health and Human Services Policy or Finance Committee hearings, regulation of healthcare providers and healthcare facilities is one very important thing we do at the Health Department. We have regulatory authority of different types over a whole bunch of different types of healthcare entities, as you see here on this slide. What we're talking about here today in the long-term care arena is nursing homes, home health agencies in particular, home care providers and assisted living providers. But you can see that our regulatory involvement goes across the entire care continuum. The Office of Health Facility Complaints, which is what has been the subject of a great deal of attention and improvement work over the last year, this office was created by the legislature in 1976, concerns dating back then that licensed healthcare facilities weren't fully complying with the standards established by state statutes and rules. So the legislature wanted to create a point of accountability within the department for reviewing allegations against licensed healthcare facilities. A number of years later, the state enacted the Vulnerable Adults Act in 1981, which expanded the responsibilities of the Office of Health Facility Complaints to include specifically investigations of abuse and neglect of residents in licensed healthcare facilities and to receive and evaluate facility-reported incidents that are also required under the VAA. So these concerns on the legislature's part go back quite some time, and these are the kind of the constructs within which we work. So over a third of Minnesotans who are older than 85 are under the care of a health facility or a home care provider, which kind of just categorically qualifies them as a vulnerable adult under the Minnesota law, under the Vulnerable Adults Act. So we're talking about a significant population in our state. We have 36,000 people today who are living in over 2,600 long-term care facilities actual facilities, and an additional 90,000 people receiving home-based care. Actually, some of those 90,000 are residing in long-term care facilities, but getting their care from a home care provider who may or may not be actually affiliated with, in an organizational structure sense, with the facility. The Office of Health Facility Complaints received over 22,000 allegation reports in 2018, which was an average of over 430 each week. That the number of complaints, of allegations, I should say, coming into the system has really increased dramatically over the recent years. Not surprisingly, as the population ages, as there are more and more long-term care facilities, the industry itself is diversifying, and also very importantly, the state created a single point of entry for reporting concerns about abuse and neglect, the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, MARC. So all of those things together, population growth, industry growth, making it easier to report has resulted in a significant uptick in the number of allegation reports. I want to give you a little more insight as we go here to what are those reports and what do we do with them. So what the Office of Health Facility Complaints investigates are, and I'm going to define these terms for you in just a minute, but the office is charged with investigating allegations that are not about maltreatment, but other allegations of failure to comply with state or federal requirements for federal and state providers, as well as specifically maltreatment allegations under the Vulnerable Adults Act for federal and state providers. Another part of the Health Department's health regulation function, the Licensing and Certification Office, works kind of side by side with OHFC, but their jurisdictions have differed in the past. Licensing and Certification deals only with federally certified providers doing compliance investigations on strictly federal providers. And the Office of Health Facility Complaints deals more broadly with maltreatment investigations and compliance investigations. Again, I'm going to define these terms for you, as it can get a little bit tricky to distinguish between what is maltreatment and what is non-maltreatment. So as an example, a general compliance concern that would be reported to us would have to do with whether a facility or a provider is complying with the terms of their licensure status or their certification. It could be things like environmental concerns, inadequate supplies, housekeeping, complaints about food, but anything that's not about the treatment of an individual that rises to that level of concern of abuse or neglect. However, important to note that we often go in on a compliance investigation, and it always can turn into an investigation about maltreatment at any time in that process if the investigators on site see something that they think needs to be investigated through the lens of the Vulnerable Adults Act. So defining maltreatment under the Vulnerable Adults Act, and just a note here, the Vulnerable Adults Act, as I mentioned, was passed in 1981. Since that time, federal standards and federal quality regulation has evolved quite a lot. So it used to be that our state's standards for abuse and neglect were quite different than the federal. Those have actually converged over time. So one of the things we're looking at now is the degree to which the state and federal definitions overlap or contradict, or where does the state law go beyond the federal law by intention, and how can we get a little more focused in terms of just how we deploy our resources on these various kinds of investigations. So, again, under the Vulnerable Adult Act, key terms, what constitutes maltreatment is either abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. And you can see here the definitions of each of these key terms. So that is what we mean when we say a maltreatment investigation. It can be any one of these three things or a combination thereof, of abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. The definition of abuse is acts that meet criminal definitions, assault, drugging, prostitution, sexual conduct, or conduct which produces pain, injury, emotional distress, malicious oral, written, or gestured language or treatment considered by a reasonable person to be disparaging, derogatory, humiliating, harassing, or threatening, or an aversive procedure, deprivation, confinement, seclusion, or separation through physical or chemical restraints. So again, these are state standard definitions for what constitutes abuse. Important to note that the health department does not conduct criminal investigations. Those are handled by local law enforcement. At times, we may be investigating in parallel between the Office of Health Facility Complaints and local law enforcement. And we do send, when we find a substantiated case through our investigations, that information is shared with law enforcement. So just, again, for you to refer back to these definitions are really quite important to understanding when we go in to investigate an allegation, whether it meets these definitions or whether it doesn't. The next category of neglect, really two categories or two types of neglect that the Vulnerable Adults Act spells out, neglect by the caregiver or self-neglect. So that this would be failure or omission by the caregiver to supply a vulnerable adult with necessary care or services, and failure or omission to maintain the vulnerable adult's health or safety. Okay, so those are important just terms to note as we get into talking about what we do with these allegation reports and the findings that come from them. Financial exploitation, I think, fairly straightforward there. Additional responsibilities for a fiduciary or for any person. I mentioned before, one of the reasons that we've seen the allegation reports rise is a good thing. We're making it easier for people to report concerns through the MARC system. This is a 24/7 telephone-based call center, and it's that intake central intake point, which is responsible for getting all of the complaints and sending those complaints to the appropriate agency with jurisdiction over that type of provider or that type of setting or that type of complaint. So it's MARC provides, which is managed by the Department of Human Services, provides a very important front-end triage process to getting things quickly to law enforcement and emergency protection if the complaints are, the allegations are of that nature. So we work hard, all of us, to make sure that the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center is a resource that is known to Minnesotans, and they are encouraged to use it.
Commissioner Balcom,
we have a member's
yes.
question. Representative Grudenhagen, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just on these abuse things, do nursing homes get rated by the number of abuses they have? Is there any rating system? So if I want to put my mom or dad in a nursing home, is there a way for me to find out they've had 1,000 a week complaints or, you know, what, 432 complaints a week? I don't know how you get that. I'm sure some of them are miscellaneous or, just people not happy being in a nursing home. I haven't met anybody who wants to go to a nursing home.
Right.
But is there a rating system on nursing homes?
There, Madam Chair and Representative, there is a nursing home report card that DHS has put together along with the federal government. And one of the things you'll see in our work group reports is the suggestion that we should do a similar thing for assisted living facilities to create more consumer information. As well, there are resources like the Ombudsman's Office, Senior Linkage Line, that also pull together good kind of consumer-oriented descriptions that help people make these choices. But we do try to feed that data into the DHS system.
So, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just to follow up. Thank you. So when you put out these reports, are they relatively easy for the public to access? And number two, is it allegations or it's actual findings of abuse?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair, Representative, we're going to get into that data in just another couple slides here, because you're absolutely right. There's when you look at the allegations that come in, and then you'll see in a few minutes what percentage of those or what number of those actually end up being investigated on site, and of those, when do we substantiate a finding of abuse or neglect or financial exploitation. And that is all data that we're committed to being very transparent with. And all of the reports of the on-site investigations do get posted publicly.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. And when was MARC initiated, implemented?
I think that was about 5 years ago. Just looking to see if anybody's got a precise date. July 1st, 2015 was when the MARC system went operational. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Proceed, please.
So just to give you a little sense of what happens when we, as Representative Grunhagen just asked, like, so you get this large volume of allegations coming into the office, and the health department receives about, I think, 40% of the total volume of the allegations that come through the MARC system. MARC sends some of them directly to law enforcement, some of them to Department of Human Services. So you might be interested in looking at just that larger data pool of what comes into MARC, but I'm just able to speak to the allegations that get routed to MDH for processing. So within once MARC sends, or once a facility self-reports to us, then there are several steps to the process. The triage process up front is where we do some desk review, if you will, of what is the issue here, and does it rise to the level that someone should go investigate on site. And then assignments are made based on the severity of the allegation. We've been working very hard to try to make sure that the most that in any allegations that have the potential for ongoing harm are jumped to the head of the queue, so to speak, so that we get out and investigate very quickly the most serious of the complaints. But if we are going on site, if the severity of the allegation and the supporting data seem to indicate this is not just a matter of somebody misplaced their misplaced something that was found a day later, or somebody was complaining about the food service, but this is an abuse or neglect situation potentially that needs on-site investigation, then the investigators go out and gather a whole bunch of information, reviewing records, interviewing the complainant, the staff, other residents, family members, healthcare providers, etc. So at the end of that investigation process, there are one of three possible findings with an investigated allegation. It is either substantiated, and again, this is under the Vulnerable Adult Act, that a preponderance of the evidence shows that an act meeting the definition of maltreatment occurred. So it's not just might it have, but is there a preponderance of the evidence that it did? An unsubstantiated complaint shows by contrast that a preponderance of the evidence shows that the act meeting the definition of maltreatment did not occur, either that the act didn't occur or that it didn't meet the definition of maltreatment under the law. Inconclusive means there just wasn't enough evidence to say either way, that it did or it didn't happen, or it did or it didn't meet the definitions. So those are really important terms that can really complicate, I think, the whole discussion of this, because I know that from the consumer's perspective, it can be really unsatisfying to get an investigation report back that says, well, this is inconclusive, or it's unsubstantiated, which can feel to the person who's had the experience as though we're dismissing their concerns. And one of the really important things we are trying to improve about this process is that we will do a better job of using the data that are collected on investigations that result in something other than a substantiated finding. But clearly it's the substantiated findings that give rise to the enforcement actions that I'll talk about in just a moment.
I think we have a question, Representative Keel. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, Is it a possibility that there could be a substantiated concern, but the resident did not want it talked about?
Commissioner Malcolm?
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, that's a really insightful question, actually. There, it part of what can make it difficult to investigate these kinds of situations is people's oftentimes reluctance to share the information or to give the investigators the corroborating evidence that they're looking for. So it's a very good point. It could be that there are times when things are inconclusive or not substantiated, which doesn't mean there wasn't a bad outcome, but just that the investigatory process was not able to validate it under this preponderance of the evidence standard. But I think it does go to the importance of making sure that we're using all of the information that we gather through these processes for purposes of working with consumers, with consumer advocates, with the ombudsman, and with the industry itself to see what are the trends, what are the concerns that are being reported, and what can we do of a preventive nature to improve quality going forward.
Representative Keel? Okay, please proceed. Okay.
So what do we do with substantiated findings of maltreatment? We can and do find either individual providers responsible for a substantiated finding of abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation, or we could find the provider, the facility, responsible, or both, an individual care provider and a facility. If the individual is not licensed, what we do with a substantiated finding is to recommend a disqualification determination to the Department of Human Services Background Studies Unit to put into their database and to make a determination about whether that unlicensed individual should be disqualified from working in the field. If the individual is licensed, we share the maltreatment findings with the respective licensing board, and the licensing board is what makes the final determination about any restrictions on the license of the licensed individual. All maltreatment determinations, whether they are substantiated, not substantiated, or inconclusive, are subject to an appeals process, and we make sure that providers and complainants residents or family members are aware of their appeal rights under the Vulnerable Adults Act. So where we have been with all of this, as members may well remember, March 1st of 2018, the Office of the Legislative Auditor issued a very comprehensive report on what had happened with the backlog that had built up of all these allegation reports coming in, too many of which that had not been investigated in a timely way, and too many investigations were open for a very long period of time. And the report did a really, I think, thorough kind of diagnostic job on helping us understand what had happened, how the concerns had gotten to this point, and what were some of the system failures and the things we needed to do to fix it. They called out the significant time lags that we had, lack of communication to families and providers, the fact that the whole system was a really antiquated paper-based system, that we had lots of staffing and morale concerns in that part of the agency. In all, there were 23 recommendations that the auditor made about things we should fix operationally within MDH, and we've been working hard to do that. Governor Dayton created an interagency agreement between the Health Department and the Department of Human Services, where we were able to tap into the expertise at the Department of Human Services. They'd worked through some similar kinds of challenges in parts of their operation. So we were able to tap into some great continuous improvement expertise of theirs and extra resources to help us work through the backlog of cases that hadn't been looked at. We didn't know what was in those records. And we were able to clear out that literal pile of paper of 2,300 cases that we weren't sure what was in them or what had been done with them. Turned out that some of them had, in fact, been investigated but never never properly logged and closed out. That's part of the paper-based problem. But we were able to move through that backlog and get things into their proper category of needing investigation or not needing investigation and into the investigation process. That was all cleared out by February 28th. And the backlog of investigations from prior years that had been sitting open was cleared in August. Now, I'll be the first to say, with this volume of incoming allegations, we are still not where we need to be in terms of timeliness at getting all these allegations investigated or sorted for investigation or not, and then on-site investigations closed in the amount of time we need and want to close them in. But we have now put in place a system where every incoming report has eyes on it within 2 days, such that we know, you know, when something really needs to be accelerated. Another just important thing to note from last year, Governor Dayton at the end of 2017 asked a number of consumer organizations to come together and bring him recommendations from the consumer's perspective on what needed to change, both in the department and in state law in terms of protecting elders and vulnerable adults. And that, as you know, there were a number of bills introduced last year and debated, coming from the consumer advocacy groups, advanced a lot of important ideas. So where we are today, I like to say we have the improvement progress that has been made inside the Office of Health Facility Complaints with a lot of help from DHS has been really quite impressive. Not only have we worked through backlogs, but we're literally re-engineering everything about our processes, taking the Office of Legislative Auditor's recommendations very much to heart about the things that needed to be improved, standardized, automated, subjected to audits for quality control purposes. And I feel really good about the improvements that have been made, but I always caveat that by saying we're not finished by any means, and the improvements we have made I still would characterize as fragile. There's still improvements that need to be hardwired. People are still getting trained on new work processes, and we just really need to make sure it's kind of like, you know, the proverbial, you know, building the car while you're driving it down the highway. We just need to make sure that the process improvements that we put in place really are being followed consistently and continuously improved, because we don't get everything right on the first try. So in the volume, you can see here we've received about over 22,000 reports. Those are both complaints from consumers or families and facility self-reports. Facilities are supposed to report to us within 24 hours if they're aware of something that could be a case of abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation under the law. And facilities, by and large, do a good job of that, of self-reporting anything they're aware of. So a large number of the reports that come into the system are from facilities themselves saying we think something might have happened. Now, oftentimes, a day later, they find out that the thing that they were concerned about has been corrected or didn't actually happen. So there is a lot inside this data that really does deserve to be parsed more finely. Yes,
ma'am. What happens if they don't report within 24 hours?
If we find out later that they failed to report something that we became aware of, then that becomes a potential compliance concern against them. So there's not an explicit, you know, fine for the failure to report, but it's kind of goes into our overall review of the facility.
So the default is report and then investigate, but report early.
Report early and correct it later is very much the operating norm. So of all those reports that came in, about 1,400 of them were assigned for on-site investigation, that the reviewers thought that the allegation was met the state standards potentially, or that we needed to go on-site to see if the evidence validated that there was abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. There were about 780 investigations that were completed in 2018 that were received in that same year. But we closed a total of 1,400 investigations in the year 2018, still cleaning up some of those old investigations. So there were lots of investigations processed and concluded in 2018. And you see there kind of the breakdown of those that were investigated. 236 of the allegations were substantiated, 127 were found to be inconclusive, 416 were not substantiated. Just that doesn't necessarily mean anything in isolation, but just sort of for your interest, kind of how the findings break down. We have improved a lot of the workflows that I mentioned and the management practices, but really need to stay on that. We're working hard to improve our communication with people who make these allegations, both the potential victims themselves and their families. We have replaced our reliance on paper with a series of interim electronic tools and electronic processes instead of moving literal pieces of paper from one person to another. The documents are now electronically managed, which helps us get things assigned much more quickly and also helps us to pull data. I couldn't have given you those numbers that I just gave you prior to just a few months ago without somebody going and doing a whole lot of manual pulling of paper files. So the fact that we have these tools now is going to enable us to do a much better job of reporting trends and giving you a much more granular sense of what's going on inside these processes.
Malcolm, I'm going to interrupt. I think Representative Gruenhagen has a question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Commissioner, so of the 236 substantiated, what is the were there fines, penalties, people went to jail? Or, of course, these aren't criminal, right?
Correct.
Said 40% is handled by your department, 60% must go to criminal then?
We do, either to DHS or to law enforcement. Okay. And as I mentioned, for substantiated complaints, we share those reports with law enforcement, and law enforcement occasionally decides to take further action on the basis of our investigations. But the substantiated complaints either go to licensing boards, if it's a provider who holds a license, a nurse, physician, for example. And sometimes, yes, facilities are fined. And occasionally, as just happened, was reported in the paper in the Star Tribune over the weekend, occasionally we will suspend a license or certification or authority to operate.
Just one follow-up, Madam.
Go ahead, Representative.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so is this an area we need to update? Would that and make a little stronger? Would that reduce the complaints, you think? Or do you think we're about right in terms of the consequences where you substantiated maltreatment?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Madam Chair and Representative, that is among the recommendations that we will bring forward are the ability to impose fines more quickly in the process rather than waiting until after a second and third incidents, for example. So I think the regulatory consequences do need to be commensurate with the degree of harm, if you will. And we're not sure that we're really there yet.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Proceed.
Okay, so this is just a little bit further detailing some of the areas that we've improved. I mentioned the electronic processes, the fact that managers are now using much more standardized tools to oversee the work and to make sure that things are being done not only consistently but at a high quality level. I mentioned we've changed almost everything about this process, including really looking at how jobs are constructed and what the job duties are that can accompany the technology tools and the process redesigns that we put in place. So just a tremendous amount of change that the staff in this area have been participating in, but having to work through as well. We've updated and improved the public reports. There was a question earlier about what happens with these reports. We've tried to improve the reports themselves so that they are more helpful to those who have filed the complaint. They are all posted. All the results of investigations, of on-site investigations, are posted publicly. We continue to do work to audit whether the new processes are working as they should and how to further improve them. I mentioned standardization. That's been something that the legislative auditor called out as really lacking, documented processes and ways of holding people accountable, whether those are the folks in the office doing the sorting of these into categories or whether it's the investigators who are going on site, that we have to create better tools, better guidance for people to do the work in a consistent way. We just feel very strongly that this, now that we have this kind of this new awareness and a new set of tools for continuous quality improvement, that needs to just become part of how we do our work, and that we will continue to take a continuous improvement approach to all of this. I mentioned we have tried to get better at how we're communicating with complainants and families, the letters that we write, making sure that people have phone numbers and the ability to contact a person to find out what's the status of their complaint, and that we always make sure people know what their appeal rights are and that they can talk to someone about our findings. A very important public accountability tool, we think, is this weekly dashboard that we post on the Health Department website. And this is where this is current data of what's the volume of allegation reports coming into the system, and what type of facilities are they from, and what type of issues are we finding in the adjudication process. So there's a lot of data on this dashboard, we continue to evolve it with the input of providers and consumer groups and policymakers. So we would commend this to you as a tool for kind of keeping track of our progress in real time as well. So where we're going, I mentioned we're just going to continue this work of standardizing our work processes, getting through the long list of recommendations that the legislative auditor had for us. We've also taken an opportunity to not just look at the Office of Health Facility Complaints, but to broaden out kind of some of our learnings about our processes into other elements of the department's health regulatory functions as well, particularly the license and certification division and the home care and assisted living program, all of which can benefit from some of the same kind of thought process and continuous improvement that we've been working on this last year. I'm also very interested in, we all are, in continuing the discussion with DHS about, having learned a lot about how our work is similar and some of the places in which it's different, how do we continue to work together with DHS and consider ways that we can augment each other's expertise and capacity. Also, this very, very important point, and the legislative auditor really stressed this in last year's report, that we need to do a better job of using all the data that flow through the system. It isn't just a matter of saying how many of the allegation reports were substantiated. It's what are some of the trends and some of the issues, and can we get into more of a prevention mode at taking all this data, doing trend analysis just like we do in acute care. We issue health alerts if something funny seems to be going on with sepsis or whatever. We should be doing the same thing with long-term care. So I think the next presenter will talk a little bit about some of the ways in which we're wanting to work in a much more proactive way with all of this data. I'm going to just wrap up here by talking about the policy recommendations. I mentioned the legislative auditor's report was significantly focused on what does MDH need to do to fulfill our obligations, but the auditor also said part of the issue is that Minnesota's regulatory scheme has not necessarily kept pace with changes in the aging of the population, changes in the long-term care industry, the fact that people with much more complicated conditions are staying for longer periods of time in these heretofore unlicensed assisted living facilities. So the auditor aimed a number of recommendations at the legislature to consider updating the regulatory framework itself. We did have some discussions during 2018, but the discussions at the end of session were all in the context of the bigger budget bill, and we just never really had the time to really drill into where some bipartisan common sense agreement could be reached across the bodies on filling some of these regulatory gaps. So after the session concluded this fall, we at the department, I as commissioner, just decided it would be a good thing if we could keep the conversations going. And so we just created some informal working groups, was not chartered by the legislature or the governor or me in any official way, but just saying, hey, let's have some meetings and let's get some voluntary work groups going to have stakeholders talking to each other rather than talking separately, you know, really able to exchange perspectives and educate each other. And I think we had some really excellent conversations that I think I am highly hopeful is going to lead us to the ability to bring forth recommendations to the legislature that are more thoroughly understood by the stakeholders and that we've had a chance to kind of understand kind of what the implications of some different reform strategies might be. So we had six work groups, one on licensure approaches for assisted living facilities, one, as mentioned earlier, that DHS led on creating a report card for assisted living, similar to what exists for nursing homes, a work group on certification of dementia care units in particular, a work group led by the Ombudsman on consumer rights, how do we better educate on what they are and how do we strengthen them where they need to be strengthened, a work group on electronic monitoring and care facilities, which you'll also hear about today, and one on prevention strategies to improve quality and safety. So I'm just so grateful for all the time that members of the community spent on these work groups and to the volunteer leaders of the work groups who did this just on their own time and with extra work.
I'm going to let you breathe for a second, Commissioner Malcolm. I just want to thank you and your team on helping address the backlog of these complaints. And I guess I would like to know at some point, you know, if you have the resources you need, given all the complaints coming in to address them, what's the staffing ratios like? Are you going to be asking for more resources? And I was able to participate in a few, and I know other members were in some of the work groups, so I want to thank them also for working on this. We are very committed to put legislation forward and pass it this session to address these very serious concerns about abuse of our elderly and vulnerable adults. So I am committed to doing that. I know other members around this table are committed, and we're going to be working really closely with the Senate in a bipartisan way to push something forward. So, but thank you for taking this on and really helping us address these issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you know, we're still in the process of making budget proposals to the governor and as well as policy proposals like what you're going to hear about next in terms of creating a new licensure framework for assisted living that would have some resource implications.
I believe Representative Grunhagen, you have a question?
Just one more follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I've received complaints of next of kin who want to access information about a complaint in terms of their senior citizen that's in a nursing home, and they seem not to be able to do that. What is the procedure? Let's say I'm a sibling of, my mom and dad are in a nursing home, and I suspect there's been abuse complaint filed. Mm-hmm. To a certain degree, it's been documented, and I want to see what that is. Do I have a right to see that? Does it take a power of attorney, or what does it take?
Yeah, I think we are, Madam Chair, Representative, we are bound by those kinds of constraints on the ability to share data only with people who have the legal right to see the data. I'm going to just ask my staff, who's here, if there's any other response that you would make to the question of how can family members get access to data.
Do you feel free to come to the table and testify and just give your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Krieger. I am the interim director for the Office of Health Facility Complaints. To help further answer the question, I would refer you back to the Vulnerable Adults Act in data management under subdivision 12B, where it talks about during the investigation, data collected under this section are confidential data on individuals or protected non-public data as defined in section 13.02. So the information that we receive for a complaint that comes in, we consider confidential information.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen, follow-up.
So would that mean that if I have power of attorney, I can't access it as a sibling, or that's state law, or is that federal?
This is state law under the Vulnerable Adults Act. As far as if you have a complaint that comes into our office that goes through the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, or if you have an investigation that's investigated by our agency, that is a little bit different. If there's an investigation, then a data request can be put in for that investigative information.
Representative Grunhagen. Okay, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do those rules also apply to the facility? Should they inform, typically they inform a family member that there's an incident that's happened? What is their requirement for privacy also, and who can they release it to? I guess I'm referring to the fact that sometimes a loved one has a power of attorney but may not, it's probably not the whole family. So what is the law set on that?
Ms. Krieger or Commissioner Krieger? Sorry, Ms. Krieger or Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can't speak for the facility or the provider as to what information that they provide to the family. The information that comes in to the Office of Health Facility Complaints or to the Department of Health regarding a facility report, yes, is confidential information, and that's something that was debated last year at legislative session as to if that would be required to be notified the family member.
Representative Keel, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered if maybe if there's somebody that represents facilities here that could talk about how they deal with that same issue, because family is looking for information, whether it is through the office or the resident, that the facility that their family member is living in.
So do you want to hold that for the end, or do you want to bring, is there a facility in the room that might be able to help address Representative Keel's question? Do we have any provider willing to do that?
Okay,
we'll put a pin in that and we'll come back. Oh, maybe we do. Toby, come on down. So just introduce yourself for the record.
Toby Pearson with Care Providers in Minnesota. Representative Keel, the easiest answer for me to give you right now, right here, without doing a little bit more research, is that the providers are going to comply with the law. A lot of times that's very frustrating for families because, as you just heard, the data is classified in a certain way. That being said, I think there are different providers who handle it differently out there, and that may be frustrating, but we always tell them you have to comply with the law.
Representative Keel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's exactly what I was pointing to, that it becomes complicated for the facility as well as the office because of the law and what family wants to know. And I've learned in my personal life that sometimes the loved one, the resident, doesn't want to share it with the entire family. And so then the facility or the Office of Health Facility Complaints gets stuck in the middle. Mm-hmm. So I guess that was just my point. So thank you.
Good point. Thank you, Mr. Pearson.
Madam Chair, I might just suggest, since this is an area of interest and concern, that we could do a better job of coming back and laying out what are the constraints on information sharing right now, and what you know, kind of where do those constraints arise.
Okay, so, we'll note that and make sure you're back or someone's back. We'll take a deeper dive into this issue and fix the bill. Representative Gruenhagen.
Yeah, I'd appreciate if we bring that back, Madam Chair, that you know that you'd have the statute and a bullet point so it's readily understandable for lay people, which we all are, I think, sitting on, or most of us are at least sitting on here. But I would be very interested in that. So,
thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. Okay, any other questions on this topic? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Over the weekend, I had a call from a woman. She's over 70, and she lives in one of our larger counties. She's getting a letter that says she's losing her benefits on January 31st. And she thinks it's because she's classified wrong, and she mentioned the legislative auditor's report saying that there is a lot of misclassification. And as it happens, she said she's classified as an adult with a child, which she has no children. She is disabled, and she's called several people within the particular department of the county, and nobody's able to help her, and she says, plus the fact people have been very rude when they're talking with her. And I can't give you examples of that right now, but she's, you know, she called me, because she's not in my county, but she said, this can't be just happening to her. And so the thought is, and I know she called one of the county, one of our commissioners the other day as well. And again, nobody attempts to help her or lead her on. So is there, I've got a lot of telephone numbers she gave me, so I'll be doing some research, but it just seems this is a good opportunity.
Commissioner Malcolm?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm not sure if that would be in our department at the Department of Health, or whether that's something that's done at the county caseworker level. If it has to do with waiver eligibility, I'm thinking it's probably a county or human services eligibility kind of a question. But certainly happy to follow up with the details, see if we can help get the question to the right person.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was the point I was making is she just, how to put it, she kept saying that they didn't talk to her with what she considered a degree of respect. The fact that they're not helping her at all is not helpful either.
Yeah, we'll figure that out. Thank you, Representative Mason, for bringing that forward. So do you want to proceed now to talk about the working group?
Yes, thank you. So I mentioned the six working groups that we had. I'll talk just very briefly about the licensure work group. So we, as you might recall from last session, one of the legislative auditor's big points was that Minnesota is rather unique in not licensing assisted living facilities. We have a highly regulated nursing home industry, but far more people now are living in and receiving services in assisted living facilities, which just didn't have a regulatory construct that was very clear. The facilities themselves are registered as housing with services providers, but also many of them have a home care license to actually provide the services. But assisted living itself as a concept has not had a licensure framework to it in Minnesota, which is different than most states, which do license assisted living facilities. So our work group took a look at what are some of the benefits of the system that we have now, which really looks at the housing and the services as two separate things rather than one integrated thing. The work group members all agreed that one of the things that makes it difficult to understand what we're even talking about when we talk about regulation of assisted living is that different parts of law apply to different things. And the landlord-tenant law applies to some things. The licensures and certification statutes apply to some things. The home care law applies to some things. So one idea, just for understanding what is it that we've got is to pull together all the concepts that relate to assisted living into one place. But the more really substantive set of recommendation is this, that what we currently have, this housing with services notion, you're a housing with services establishment with a registration but not with a licensure, that evolve into a kind of a tiered regulatory system where there would be increasing regulation tied to the level of services offered and the complexity of the people that are being served in that facility, and also the degree of control that consumers have or don't have over the mix of services that they're getting. The whole idea of a less regulated alternative to nursing homes has great appeal, but the work group did agree that the theory of this really wide open choice system isn't working as well kind of on the ground because of lack of clarity for consumers about what really services are offered, who's responsible for them, and that it is a very complex regulatory system to even figure out which parts of several laws apply to which situations. So the proposal is to really streamline and simplify and clarify that, and to really define some of the key terms in statute, so that when we say housing with services only or what are supportive services, that's a defined term in law, as opposed to services that go beyond housing or beyond supportive services and into the provision of health care. So the notion is that housing with services, there are lots of supportive housing arrangements that's not what we're talking about here. So that would remain a registration system and something managed by DHS. But once you're going beyond housing and supportive services connected to housing, we would move into a licensure system with increasing standards that level two, so level one really is, we're not talking about licensure for that, level two would begin to trigger a requirement for the assisted living provider to be licensed, and offering basic health care services would be pulled, that those standards would be pulled out of the current home care law. A level three facility would be offering comprehensive health care services with that definition pulled from the home care law. And level four would be facilities or units within facilities that offer dementia or memory care. So the notion is that there would be higher regulatory standards the higher you go on this complexity ladder, if you will. And in the law, we would specify physical plant requirements. We'd do more around the ways in which clients are evaluated and admitted to make sure that folks are going into facilities that are appropriate for their needs. More specificity and standard language in marketing materials, more disclosures to prospective clients and residents, and new requirements for lease or service terminations in these facilities. And the notion that even if services are subcontracted by different providers within the assisted living facility, that one license holder would be responsible for compliance. So that's kind of the architecture. MDH has been, since the work group concluded, all six work groups working on draft language to put these ideas into language that we hope to be able to share very soon. We're just working that through with the governor's office.
Great. Wonderful. Wonderful news. Any questions, members, on assisted living licensure? Go ahead, Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, could you say a little bit more about what the criteria for client evaluation and admission procedures might look like? Because it seems like, so I'm a pastor and walk with families as they are making these sorts of transitions. It seems like a big challenge is that they're being admitted to a facility that isn't appropriate or so quickly are moving out of what's appropriate for them. So can you say more about what that process would look like to set them up for success?
Madam Chair and Representative, I think the idea is that whereas today there's nothing in the regulatory process that would require a facility to document how they do assessments, how it is that they evaluate clients for the appropriateness of the fix. So, and there are some best practice standards that we think can be shared more broadly across the industry, but just creating more requirement that that be a thorough process that's grounded in some standards and is documented as to how client evaluations are done.
Representative Lippert,
thank you,
Commissioner. I think, are you going to present the next piece?
Okay. I'm going to turn that over, but I just want to thank you again for the luxury of a little bit of time to give you all that background, and I look forward to working with you this session.
Great.
Thank you very much.
We look forward to working with you as well. And I just want to point out to members that there's a summary report from MDH called Elder and Vulnerable Adult Abuse Prevention Working Group, so that should be in your packet, and hopefully it's online or it will be posted online later today if you're out in the audience. Okay, our next presenter, let's see, can you introduce yourself for the record? Is it Marie Dotsa?
That's right.
Okay.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marie Dotsa. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you very much for letting me have some time to talk about one of the six working groups, and that one is the Improving Quality and Safety in Long-Term Care Settings. I think that the commissioner had already mentioned in her remarks how important we think it is to take all this information and make sure that we're learning from it, that something is changing as a result of all this activity that we're doing. And so I just point out that we envision the work that we did in this committee to be in addition to the reforms in the regulatory process. So this isn't instead of those changes. This is work that we would do in addition to those changes. So I'll just go really quickly through what we did, and then if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those. So our committee met four times through the fall and into this winter. And in addition to that, we had a committee of the whole meetings. So these working groups would go off and they would meet, and then they would come back together and we would all meet jointly so that we could identify shared learning and some themes that came out across the many work groups. And I have an example of that. I think each of the working groups identified something like workforce shortages and workforce training as important issue for all of the work that we're doing and a theme that runs throughout. So we had a lot of time to exchange information as well. Our working group developed some shared values and a vision for what we would like to see ideally. We identified some barriers to achieving that, and then we developed a draft charter to guide our work in an ongoing way. A lot of the work groups kind of had right now as an end to their work to deliver a product that would recommend some regulatory or legislative changes to be brought to you, and this working group was different in the respect that we envisioned us exploring opportunities for continuing collective action from the stakeholders and regulators and providers at the table. So this list of the ideal system, some of the shared values, might seem pretty intuitive to you, but it was something that we came to and kind of solidified over the course of the process that we did, that we wanted transparent information that was easy for everyone to use and understand, residents, families, and providers. That was the theme of our work throughout. We also wanted to make sure that whatever we did was person-centered and person-directed. Another theme from the work that we did is that we wanted to have accountability and we wanted to have learning, that we wanted a system that continues to learn, continues to evolve. You'll see there that our desire is for a well-trained workforce, and as I said before, you'll see that's also one of the barriers that we identified. We wanted to make sure that the regulatory system supported improvements and enabled those to the extent possible, and we wanted to have ways to track our progress that could be useful now and evolve over time. I won't mention for the fourth time the workforce challenges, but it's a constant theme for some of our work, and you will hear about it more, I'm sure. We want to make sure that to the extent that we are able, that the regulatory systems we put in place help to enable that learning culture, that we get a lot of information in and we're able to trend it, theme it, and turn it around. We have interesting challenges around the terminology that we use that's very legalistic around things like substantiated, unsubstantiated, and inconclusive. And it's not very validating to think that your experience was an unsubstantiated claim. And we in no way mean that there is not something that can be learned from that report and that information and what we saw. It just doesn't meet certain legal thresholds and technical legal definitions. But we want to make sure that we are still able to learn from a broad variety of inputs that we get at the department. So we know that that terminology can sometimes be a barrier. We also know that there's competing priorities for energy and time. I mean, we're making some pretty massive changes that we're undertaking here, and we want to make sure and leave space that we are always looking toward improvement out of the other end. We know that we live in a society that's rapidly changing. It's aging. There are increasing incidents of elder abuse in the community. So we are living in a system that's constantly changing as well. So one of the things I want to make sure and mention, our committee was very focused that we would like to have in all of our improvement efforts and work, we would like to be able to include frontline staff that work in these organizations and residents in all of the work that we do. That is very challenging, but it's a goal that we have, and we'd like to make sure that they're included in what we come up with. So part of our charter for ourselves in moving forward is that we want to move from a general exploration to some specific improvement projects and topics. So the group intends to identify and select projects for collective action. And I'll just pause a moment and underline collective action. We know that there's a lot of great quality improvement work going on in the community generally by a number of different parties, and this isn't any way meant to duplicate that work. This is where can we be more effective if we worked together and that we could have measurable improvement. And we've listed just some possible potential projects right now, looking at making data more available, more available and useful, that we would have tools and guidance to enable accurate and comprehensive reporting, so improving the quality of the information coming in, and advancing a culture of safety for all of us to do this improvement work. So that is... that's where our work group stands right now. We have put the information for this work group and all of the work groups as part of the Minnesota Department of Health webpage. And if you have the electronic version on these slides, these are all linked too. So you can see the minutes from each of the working groups and what we have done so far. So with that, I will pause for questions.
Sure. Thank you. And your title is Assistant Commissioner, so I apologize for not using that title. Representative Gruenhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your report.
Thank you.
And the work you're doing. The one caution I would have is that, and this is just an initial thought, is sometimes out of these working groups, it results in increased paperwork. And pretty soon they're doing more paperwork and reports than they are taking care of the patient. We see this in special ed. We see this, you know, when government tries to solve a problem, it seems like they generate, not all the time, but generally, more and more paperwork. And a lot of the paperwork just gets filed away, and it just becomes, you know, and I hear that locally at the county and when I was on the school board and et cetera, et cetera. So I just caution that we don't, you know, overdo it. I personally would lean, my initial thought would lean to stronger consequences for these problems versus more and more reports. And I think that would send a stronger message to everybody that it's unacceptable. So it's just a suggestion that we don't overwhelm them with paperwork and more reports, okay? Because I think they're probably filling out enough the way it is already between federal and state. But thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was a comment rather than a question, right? No question there? Okay, Representative Cleaborne.
I just would like a clarification in one of the slide comments. So on the collaborative efforts to improve quality and safety, the second bullet point says regulatory system that does not enable a learning curve, but I thought I heard you say it does enable a learning curve. So
a learning culture.
Okay, yeah, culture.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Okay, thank you, culture.
Yes. Yeah. So what that is that sometimes there's a constraint or a barrier that, and it might relate to the comment just previous to that, that sometimes there's a lot of paperwork and there's a lot of work that is required but might not necessarily end up resulting in quality improvement, or that we're not taking the opportunity to connect the pieces and learn from in the way that we would like to be able to. And so this is just identifying that there sometimes is a barrier to doing the kind of improvement work that we want. We need to knit those pieces together better and keep focused on improving quality.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative and Assistant Commissioner. Any other questions for the Assistant Commissioner? Nope, not seeing any. Thank you so much for your presentation. We look forward to working with you on those quality improvement initiatives.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so we will send out an electronic copy of these slides so you have the electronic links to those websites for the working group reports as well. Okay, next up we have Sean Burke from the Minnesota Elder Justice Center talking about electronic monitoring in our care facilities. Mr. Burke, please introduce yourself for the record. I think this slideshow is on the desktop, already preloaded, so unless you're just getting your notes up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just grab it then. Thank you, Madam Chair, and as I'm getting organized and getting that presentation, our working group report can be found on page 20, starting on page 20 of the full report.
Okay, so members, you have the slide deck in front of you, and on page 20 of the report from MDH is the full report. So we're looking like we're having some technical issues. We do have the slide deck in front of us, so if you can't pull it up, Mr. Burke, you could proceed to go through it. Everyone should have a paper copy of the slide deck. Mm-hmm. While we wait for that, why don't we have the pages introduce themselves? I think we have permanent pages for the committee, so why don't we do that? Go ahead.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Siebert.
Okay. And
we're not permanently on this committee.
You're not permanently.
At least I'm not.
Yeah, I am.
Helping out.
Sorry. Okay, well, thank you for helping out and getting our documents ready.
Madam Chair, members, we'll go ahead and go without, but the slides are in front of you, and there's a handout up here, so thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Sean Burke. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. We're a statewide nonprofit organization. We work to prevent and redress abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation of older and vulnerable adults. We know nationally about 1 in 10 older adults will be a victim of abuse or neglect or exploitation in their lifetime. And that risk increases to 1 in 5 if that individual has a cognitive impairment. Our staff work across the state. We provide free and confidential support and services for victims and their families. We provide professional training to law enforcement, care providers, to financial institutions, government organizations, and others to work on best practices in this work And we also work on public policy solutions to improve parts of our system that impact older and vulnerable adults. And that is why we were asked by Commissioner Malcolm to convene the electronic monitoring work group this past fall and winter. This informal work group was tasked with exploring areas of consensus and also identifying and clearly delineating areas of disagreement when it comes to electronic monitoring of resident private rooms in their facilities. So to be specific, the issue at question is whether or not a resident or someone on their behalf, such as a resident representative, has the right to place a monitoring device in their private room or unit. So we're not talking about the use of cameras throughout the facility or the use of cell phones to perhaps video something, say, in the dining room. Currently, a number of states, a handful of states, have laws on the books to address this issue, and it is a hot topic. Currently, in the North Dakota legislature, they are passing a bill this session as well. This issue first came to this legislature back in 2016, when the legislature and MDH directed a first working group on this issue. Our office also convened that working group, which met from July 2016 to January 2017 and produced a report. We like to think about that report as kind of foundational and groundwork setting. It helped build to some of the language that was introduced last year, and it helped us in our work just this past fall and winter. I'm going to talk about the outcomes that you have in front of you in that report in just a minute, but I do want to turn to the next slide, or the first slide with bullet points, to go over just some high-level concepts about what our working group was doing. Just about all stakeholders and advocates agree that a law is needed to address this particular issue. Current law is silent. Most advocacy organizations, including ours, would say that an individual or their loved one does have a right to put in a camera, but that is not universally accepted, and many facilities today disagree and will either remove a camera or prohibit them from existing. On the surface, it seems like somewhat of an easy issue, but it's not. To get it right, we have to balance privacy, safety, and autonomy of a resident. And many, many times, the resident lacks the capacity to even understand what is going on in their care. In this work group, we wanted to provide an opportunity for all stakeholders. This primarily included advocacy organizations, providers, government agencies, and others to participate in a consensus-driven set of solutions. As I mentioned, we built off the work group in 2016, and we built off of legislative language that was introduced last year. In this way, our work group was a little different than the other five work groups in that we did deep dives into legislative language and produced a variety of examples and sample language that could be used in this session. Our work group met 9 times between September and December. And as I mentioned, all participants agreed from the beginning that electronic monitoring in residential care facilities should be allowed. The goal of this legislation is to allow it and to define the legal parameters under which it can take place. So if you go to the next slide, and if you take a look at the first page, again, page 20, in that large report of our electronic monitoring workgroup report, the model that we used for this report is we identified about 15, 16 topics and subtopics that will or would form the basis of an electronic monitoring law. So what we did in the report is we provide an overview of the topic, and then we provide sample language. Sometimes we provide 2 or 3 different types of sample language to represent the variety of policy differences that existed in the group. And then when applicable, we noted some specific notes to talk specifically about word choice and why we chose certain words or phrases from others. As I mentioned, for each topic, we did a deep dive. That means at least 2 30- or 45-minute discussions on each of them. For example, if you look at the list of topics here, the definition of a monitoring device. If it's too broad, then the law could encompass literally every piece of technology that's in someone's room. But if it's too narrow, it might not be able to account for emerging and changing technologies that we can see 2, 3, 5 years down the road. So our work group built off some principles. A definition of electronic monitoring device had to define the what. It had to define what it was recording or its broadcast ability. And crucially, it had to define what's the purpose of the device. To give you a sense of how deep we dove, we debated for a long time whether the definition should use the word install or place. And the work group report gets into why that distinguishing characteristic is important. Now, for many of these topics, we found general consensus. And again, because it was an informal work group, we did not vote. And what I mean by general and what the report means by general is many of the stakeholders who came to the meetings would generally agree with the language that was developed, but that doesn't mean that every stakeholder was at every meeting, and that doesn't mean that important stakeholders who exist in the community and will be a part of conversations this session were at every meeting or potentially have some issues with some of the sample language. However, if you turn to the final slide, some of the results of our report, I think, are promising. Again, we didn't vote on any final decisions or final topics, but we came to some general consensus on some difficult issues, including the aforementioned definition of a monitoring device, the definition of a resident representative, which again is crucial because we know many of the individuals who we are trying to protect, but also balance autonomy and privacy, are those without the cognitive capacity to choose on their own. So what universe of individuals can make choices on their behalf? We also came to some general consensus on how to obtain the resident's consent and what a consent notification form would look like. I'll close by noting two areas of disagreement where more work is needed. The issue of providing notice to the facility. What that means is once an individual has chosen to place a camera in their room, or an individual's resident representative has chosen to place a camera in their room, and they go through all the aforementioned steps of getting consent and filling out a form, the question is, should they provide that form or some other notice to the facility that they're monitoring? Some advocates would say that this action raises a fear of retaliation. Many times from the individuals that we hear taking this extraordinary step are worried already that there's been a breakdown in communication with the facility, and they don't trust either the care or the administration that they're working with. Others would say, however, that notice does serve a purpose. It potentially puts the facility on notice that something is wrong, and it also helps the facility use their or fulfill their duty to protect privacy. We spent some time trying to find a compromise, and you will see that in the report, whereby individuals should be providing notice on a regular basis, but if they have a reasonable fear, for example, of that retaliation that I mentioned, then they can monitor for some period of time, say 30 days, without providing notice to account for that reasonable fear. Unfortunately, even with all the time that we spent, we ran out of time to dive enough into this type of compromise to see if it's workable, but we trust and we hope that as the session goes on, stakeholders and this body can think thoughtfully about this notice issue. Another area of disagreement was dissemination of data. Somewhat luckily, we don't have to get too sucked up into Chapter 13 of the Data Practices Act, as was brought up a little earlier in today's hearing and is the subject of another committee in this building, because we're really not dealing with government data. This is individual private property on a camera. Nevertheless, the question arises, what happens if that after that footage is captured, what happens to it, and should the law address that? And crucially, should the law address access for employees who have had an adverse action taken against them, for example, to get that data, and should that access or that due process be built into this law, or should other legal mechanisms take care of that? We thank this body's interest in this topic. We look forward to working on this issue going forward. I'll stand for questions, and am happy and excited to work with you going forward. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Burke, and thank you for working on a lot of these definitions and diving into the weeds and saving us and our research staff time and energy. So are there any questions from members? Representative Gruenhagen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for your report. Just a question. On these other states that have passed laws, is there any history we can look at to see what's working and what's not? What, did the group look at that?
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, thank you so much. We have looked at other states, and I would say, unfortunately, no one state does it alike. And I would say all of the states, based on now 3 years of working groups, two working groups and 3 years of doing this, this report is, I think, frankly, a much more comprehensive approach than any other state has. Many of the states, you'll notice the law is actually missing several of these topics, and we think all of these topics are crucial. We have reached out to a handful of states, and as you might imagine, there's kind of mixed bag. The law, I think, overall, though, is a good thing because it clarifies that you can monitor and that a facility cannot take action against you for doing that and cannot remove the camera. And that piece of clarity is, and that peace of mind is what states achieve by doing this. I think this report, and if legislation along these lines go forward, will have a more comprehensive approach than every other state.
Representative Gruenhagen, follow up? No, thank you. So Representative Munson, go ahead.
Yep, thank you. Madam Chair, and I apologize for coming late. We had some flurries down in my area, so
you're
it was
excused
typical.
For today.
This is a really interesting topic, and thank you for putting this report together and bringing this forward. What has been the input from staff that works in these facilities? I know that we're currently struggling to find staff to come there, and I know that we pay them so little. It's also frustrating, but then having to work under the being videotaped all the time. What was the input from the staff, and is that already a buy-in that they're okay with being recorded?
Mr. Burr?
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, thank you. It's a great question. So unfortunately, I think the previous presenter hit on this. It is a little difficult to get direct staff input on these issues, and most of the examples I'd give you or the data I'd give you on that would be anecdotal. Have talked to both individual providers and individual staff people that have given the general sense that it's a little troublesome and worrisome at first, but for the most part, there's a sense that for those doing good work and doing hard work, it's not this type of monitoring is something that, while it might seem intrusive, especially up front, it's something that, if they don't necessarily welcome it, they understand it. I've talked to one nurse who would even go so far as to say she really would support it because it would root out some of the bad actors. I will say that those representing staff in terms of kind of union representation, while not kind of fully at our table throughout the work groups, have been following this and we talk with. And again, the one issue that I think is really important is kind of a due process fairness issue. So that if action is taken against the staff member, potentially because of something that was found on the footage, then they would want kind of quick and easy access to that footage to address that issue. And you will not see that language in this report, but it is something that I think is a legitimate concern and should be discussed going forward.
Representative Munson, follow up?
Yeah, I do have a follow up, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. And it's interesting to hear that North Dakota is also working on this. My cousin happens to be a state representative in North Dakota, mm-hmm. although for the other party. But I'm interested in talking with her on it. Minnesota has a unique law that allows someone to record a conversation as long as one party is involved in it. We recently moved my wife's grandmother to a nursing facility. She's 97, and we had a Google Home. There, so she could call us, and I'm wondering: does the existing law prevent someone from putting that device? I know the Google Home isn't necessarily recording it for our purposes, but it is recording everything that goes on in the room. And I was wondering if the testifier could speak to that.
Mr. Burke, give the answer for that.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, as an attorney, without giving you legal advice on the current legality of the Google Home, you've actually hit on kind of the demonstrable question about why this law is needed. advocates, including our office and others, would say that because of that law, individuals should and do have the right to monitor in their own room and can use cameras or communication devices like you're talking about. The problem is that some facilities flat out legally disagree with that. And they say that because of the privacy concerns that they need to take care of, because of kind of the fact that they're providing services, that if they don't want the camera in there, if they find the camera, they can ban it from their facility. And so you can imagine the litigation that might occur to settle that question and whether or not we ever got that. This legislation would provide kind of a nice, clear end to that question. I will quickly address the Google Home because you brought it up. We talked about that device and other devices like it in that definition. And crucially, the device that you're talking about might actually come under the law if the purpose of it is to monitor the care and activities happening in the room. So it may be things like that device, based on how you're using it and the intention and what it actually does, would need to come under the purview of this law. You could still certainly do it. That right would be protected. You might, your mother, if she has capacity, would simply go through the notification process, or a resident representative of her behalf would do that. Or not notification, consent process, maybe notification, depending on where the legislature ends up. So.
Okay, so members, we are out of time, but we'll let Representative Cleavorn, she's a freshman, ask the last question. But I just want to remind you that I want to thank everybody for coming in the bad weather to this committee. And we're going to be talking a lot more about electronic monitoring when we see more bills. So this isn't the last time we're going to have this discussion, and I'm sure Mr. Burke will come back for those discussions as well. But go ahead, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is this. What about would this bill also include things like monitoring floor mats that would track traffic and movement within the room in that way, where there's no visual image?
So,
Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, Representative, another great question. We talked about those sensors. Our policy was to not include those type of sensors unless there is a audio or visual recording, and you'll see that kind of in the definition.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Burke. Okay, that ends our official business. I hope to see everybody again next week, where we're going to continue our discussion of working groups. This meeting is adjourned.